I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Leah Simone Bowen. This is Podcast Playlist. We're halfway through 2023, and as always, the past 6 months have been chock full of great new podcast releases. So it's time for the team at Podcast Playlist to once again gather around the microphones and make the case for the best podcasts of the year so far. We have the whole team here with me. Say hi, team.
Hi. Hello.
And joining us for the very first time on the show today is our executive producer, Cecil Fernandez. Hey, Cecil.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Oh, my gosh. A pleasure. A pleasure. So the rest of us have all done this before, so I'm going to put you on the spot for a bit and say that you are going to go first. What's your favorite podcast of the year so far?
Okay, so like you, I listen to a lot of podcasts, maybe too many podcasts for any of our own goods. And the one I wanted to recommend for you today is from Serial and the New York Times. It's called The Coldest Case in Laramie.
Okay.
This follows journalist Kim Barker, her return to her hometown of Laramie, Wyoming, to look into the decades-old murder of Shelley Wiley. You know, Leah, this binge released when I was on vacation earlier this year with my family. And maybe like you, I listen to a lot of podcasts for work. So this was a rare opportunity. I got to listen to a podcast just for pleasure. And I got totally sucked into the story.
Okay, so that's high praise then. Why is it your choice for the best release so far this year?
You know, for me, it comes down to Kim's journey and the questions that she goes looking for answers for. You know, she returns back to her hometown of Laramie, Wyoming, to look at this 40-year-old murder. You know, Kim is a seasoned journalist who's reported from literal war zones. And it's her curiosity throughout the series that really grabs me. There's a lot of process. There's a lot of court documents, interrogation tapes and stuff like that. But what really hooked me was the questions that she sets out to answer. She talks about memory. She talks about people's, you know, constructing stories in their mind. You know, there's so many questions at the center of this case. Police had arrested a former officer in the murder. Witnesses placed him at the scene. There was DNA even found at the crime scene. And in an interrogation, he seemingly confesses to the crime. But the charges are dropped. For me, it was Kim's dogged curiosity about the story that she wanted to know more about what happened to Shelley Wiley. The entire series makes you feel like you're walking on the streets of Laramie with Kim, following the leads and the information as they come in, and they leave you questioning how reliable a 40-year-old memory can be.
Okay, well, let me set up this clip we're about to hear. The host, Kim Barker, speaks with Shelley's former roommate, Michelle. And just a warning, this story includes discussions of sexual assault.
I remember it so well. I remember it like it was yesterday. I stayed at my boyfriend's house, and we got in a huge fight because I wanted to go home. And I said, I want to go home. I don't feel right. Something felt weird. And I remember it was either 2 or 3 in the morning. And he said, you can't go home now. It's middle of the night. Nothing's going to change between now and then. And I just said, something's wrong. I cannot describe it, and I can't tell you why. And then that morning early, I went home, and it was like 5 or 6 or something. And that's how I saw the flames. I saw the apartment still burning. And when I pulled up, that's when the officer said, who are you? And I said, I live here. And then they said, where's Shelley? And I thought, what do you mean, where's Shelley? She's in the house. And I was hysterical, just going crazy. I just could never forget those words. They said, do you know where Shelley is? And I was just like dumbfounded. So what do you mean? Do I know where she is? She's in the house. And I just went crazy, just went nuts.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
No. So shortly after Shelley was killed, I met my husband, who I'm divorced with, and married him quickly. He was 10 years older than I was. He was a high school teacher, and I was scared out of my mind. It was a scary time, and I was just searching for comfort. And that was, you know, he was 30, I was 20, and he was a high school teacher, and I thought, he's not going to hurt me. It's terrible.
And do you think that Shelley's death, I mean, I would imagine it had everything to do with that.
Oh, guarantee. Because right after, so when Shelley was killed, I was still in shock. I was so young, and I didn't even call my parents when it happened until probably, you know, the next day. And I think one of the detectives said, we got to call your parents. And then my dad wanted me to move back home because he was scared, and I wouldn't. And then somebody sent me, I rented an apartment, a basement apartment. Foster's gave me like $600 because I didn't have any clothes. All my clothes were burnt. And I didn't even have a coat, I don't even think. And so they gave me $600 so I could rent an apartment. And then somebody mailed me a card with a $100 bill in it and said, if you're smart, you'd leave town. So the detectives got the card. I called them right away because I was so scared. I thought somebody's going to come for me next, which nobody knew that I lived. I mean, I hadn't been there for more than maybe a week. And so I did leave, and I stayed home for a month. And then I felt like I was running away. I thought, I'll never be able to face my fears and face what happened. I just wanted to go back to Laramie. Yeah, but that was all just so, so surreal. That whole, you know, somebody sending me now. They think it was probably Fred that did that. You know, the detectives. But back then, they didn't know. They just kind of, I don't know. You know, all the things that he did to us while we were in that apartment, it was constant, you know. And back then, it was just so, it was so strange because Lori and I not laughed, but we were talking about how I used to work graveyards. And so one time I woke up in the middle of the day and there was a mouse inside my shirt on my belly. And how does that get there? You know, and my screens would come off of my windows all the time. And then he would say, and then I was screaming because that mouse was on my belly. I was freaking out. And he all of a sudden was at the door and was like, what's wrong? What's wrong? Do you need help? I mean, how did he know, you know, that I think he put the mouse in, I don't know. I guess I don't know that for sure, but I know for sure that he would take the screens off, ask me for help, and then say, can I come in and help you put your screens on? Or
so weird. The screens would come off. You obviously probably wouldn't see him take the screens off, but he was mm-hmm. always there saying, hey, do you need help with that?
Yes. Yeah. Hey, I noticed your screens are off. Can I help you put your screens back on and stuff? So, yeah. In hindsight now, I would say I am 99.9% sure Fred Lamb murdered Shelley. I think, you know what my gut tells me is, she smoked, he smoked. I think she went out probably when she got home. She didn't smoke in the house. She went outside to smoke because I went to Florida with my parents that June, and I brought her an ashtray from Florida, and that was outside all broken. And I think she was outside smoking. He probably came outside. He probably hit on her. She told him to go pound sand, and I bet you he tried to rape her. And that's my thought. I don't know truthfully how that all happened, but I think she was outside smoking when he started talking to her. I think she probably didn't give him the time of day. He just probably was drunk and lost it. I don't know.
From the New York Times and Serial Productions, that was The Coldest Case in Laramie. It's hosted by Kim Barker. The producer is Alvin Melleth. And that clip was chosen by our executive producer, Cecil Fernandez. Thanks, Cecil.
Thanks, Leah.
You're listening to Podcast Playlist. I'm Leah Simone Bowen. Today on the show, the top podcast of 2023 so far is chosen by us.
Okay, Leah, I went first. Now it's time for you to go. What about you? What's your favorite podcast so far of this year?
So for me so far, I'm going to go with The Evaporated, Gone with the Gods. It's an investigation into this phenomenon in Japan in which every year tens of thousands of people just disappear. And not all of them disappear because of a crime. Some people choose to leave their lives and go undercover, if you will. And they are known as The Evaporated.
Wow. And what made this better than anything you've ever heard this year?
I think because it was such an extraordinary story that I wasn't aware of, and the storytelling is really nuanced and compelling. Some parts of it are really funny, too. I mean, it just ends up going in places that you can't anticipate. So, like I said, this story takes place in Japan, and in Japan, they have these companies that can help you disappear. They're called Yonige, or Night Movers. In this clip, we're going to hear from Miho Saita, one of those companies' owners.
For those who are curious, here's how Yonigeya typically works. A client calls Saita-san, probably after finding her on the internet, like we did.
First, we confirm what kind of situation they're in. If we think their life is in danger and they say, I don't need anything, I just want to run away as soon as possible, we say, okay, we'll come get you now.
Remember when Saita-san told Tsanka that people who hold back don't live long? This quote flashed through my mind when she talked about the emergency calls she gets sometimes. The ones where, if both Saita-san and her clients don't move fast, someone could die. And it's not always who you'd think it might be.
There's been cases where I'm on a call with a client, and I can tell they've been pushed to the limit. There's been two cases where the victim couldn't take it anymore and killed their man before we could get to them.
On top of possible homicides by husband or wife, she also has to be on the lookout for people who are on the verge of taking their own lives.
In these kinds of situations, I have to stop them. Sometimes I'll be on the phone drenched in my own sweat because the phone is a lifeline.
But in most cases, there's time to plan. Some clients can't move fast or nimbly. They have a lot of stuff they want to bring with them and children they need to think about. Many have to wait for the perfect opening to escape, a time when their husbands or other family members aren't around.
There's a number of logistics Saita-san needs to work out before she sends over the Yonige truck.
Things like, do you want us to help you contact the police or get a lawyer? Or, this is how much it's going to cost you. Can you afford it? It's not fun to save us, but we're not volunteers. You need to have some money.
Saita-san may have started this company to help people out, but she's also a shrewd businesswoman. She never lends money and never accepts late payment.
I tell them, do what you need to do to get the money. I can even introduce you to a job. I mean, you can make the money you need in less than a week if it's just 50,000 yen. There's no adult that can't scrounge together 50,000 yen.
Once everything is confirmed and paid for, Saita-san starts preparing. They will often contact the police ahead of time to let them know when they're coming. This way, if neighbors mistake the Yonige workers for thieves and call the police, they'll know what's going on. Or more importantly, if the husband comes back and causes trouble, the police can intervene before someone gets hurt.
Apparently, it's happened before.
When that happens, first I'll try and explain the situation to them while the rest of my staff keep packing.
Saita-san says she also encourages clients to inform the police that they're planning to disappear. They do this so police can reject a missing person's request if their family tries to file one. They will straight up tell them, look, the person you're looking for came in and they don't want to be found.
After the truck is packed up, there's only one thing left to do.
I always ask my clients to leave a note. It basically just says, don't look for me. I always tell them to include that they've already notified the police. And what else? That it's not like they got involved in an accident or crime or something. They just disappeared. And it usually ends with, please don't contact me or the children. And if you must, use a third party. That kind of thing.
The trucks will then take their clients to a secure location, but it doesn't end there. It's also the Yonige company's job to provide sufficient aftercare. They have to make sure that the runaways are safely hidden and get the help they need to start their new lives. Clients can stay at a halfway house, where Saita-san or one of her employees also live, at least until the clients find their footing. The company can also help them find a new job and permanent housing. If they need one, they'll introduce clients to an affordable lawyer and help them with any paperwork they might need to fill out.
It's also the company's job to help clients stay hidden.
To put it simply, if you're going to move from, say, Tokyo to Saitama, you would have to be an idiot to register your new address in Saitama.
There are safety measures you can request at the government office when you register your address that make it harder for someone to find you. But it's not bulletproof.
We tell clients they can register their address to one of our addresses, a place where one of my staff or former clients live, and I might get a call from them saying, this person showed up. And I'll be like, okay, got it. But they won't have any idea where the person they're looking for actually lives.
If you're going to vanish, you need to stay invisible. They will help you get a new phone number, create a new email, teach you important tricks like don't check your old phone for messages, don't have your mail transferred to a new address. They'll show you how to make sure your bank doesn't send your statements to your old address, because your statements might list the ATMs you used. You'd be surprised what you could give away.
Jake read in a book he had lying around called Ura Haro Waku, The Underground Labor Guide, that in extreme cases, people will buy entire new identities, and sometimes Yonige companies will help their clients get one. I know Jake had his hopes up, but Saita-san's company is a bit too above board for that. They work with the police pretty often, after all.
I've heard of companies helping clients get new identities, but it's pretty illegal. You're stepping into the gray zone. If you're going to do that, I say it's better to just get married.
This is pretty common, by the way. Even some of her male employees have gotten married and taken on their wives' last names. Japan has an unusual adoption system called Yoshiengumi. It's not only designed so that parents can adopt a child, it also allows adults to adopt other adults. Usually this is to carry on the family name. It's like getting married, but not. The rules are that the person adopting the other has to be the older one. A younger person can't adopt an older person, as far as I know. This was sometimes used by gay couples to have a semblance of a marriage. It's also a system beloved of fraudsters and yakuza. It's a legal way to change your name, your last name only, and you can dissolve an adoption and get adopted by someone else. It's the perfect way to take on a new last name and thus a new identity.
There's a lot of ways to stay hidden after you make your escape, and Saita-san will help you navigate it safely and legally.
At the end of the day, though, it's up to the clients to decide how discreet they can be. And of course, how important it is to stay hidden varies a lot from situation to situation. Wherever you fall on the spectrum, though, restarting your life can be pretty difficult and kind of lonely.
Relatives can be troublesome as well. I tell my clients that even if it's just one or two people that you keep in touch with, you're increasing your risk of being found. So please cut your ties, even if it's painful.
That was The Evaporated, Gone with the Gods. It's a production of Campside Media with Sony Music Entertainment. It's hosted and reported by Jake Adelstein and Shoko Planbeck. And that is my pick for the best podcast of the year so far. I'm Leah Simone Bowen, and this is Podcast Playlist. Today on the show, the entire team is here with me to give you their choice for the best podcast so far in 2023. Up next is Kelsey Cueva, an associate producer on the show. Hey.
Hello.
So what is your pick for the best podcast so far of this year?
I've been really enjoying the podcast Vibe Check. As you know, we talk about it in
the
office.
We love it.
All the time. It's a news and pop culture show hosted by Sam Sanders, Saeed Jones, and Zach Stafford.
And what makes this show stand out to you?
Really, it's the three of them together that really make this show for me. And their approach is super welcoming, you know? It doesn't feel like traditional news where headlines are kind of aggressively being thrown at you. Mm-hmm. It's very person first. And they like to have fun. It's conversational, and it just feels like you're unpacking current events with your friends. So for me, it makes news consumption feel way less overwhelming. And after listening, I always come away feeling energized and more informed.
Well, this clip we're going to hear is specifically about the TikTok trend of dupes. Can you please explain to our listeners, and maybe to me, I mean, I know, but might as well tell me again, what is a dupe or what are dupes?
Gladly. So dupes have been around forever. In the early aughts, people called them knockoffs.
Okay.
So I'm talking about bootleg luxury items. Think designer clothing brands, makeup, tech, you know, anything that's popular with a high price tag. So Gen Zers are calling them dupes, which explained why on TikTok a few months ago, I started seeing tons of videos of teens walking around stores like Walmart and Target, holding up items and going, dupe.
Victoria's Secret, dupe.
Levi's, dupe.
Gucci belt, dupe.
I got it. Is it like duplicate? Like
yeah.
It's the short of duplicate. Okay, got it.
I think so, I believe.
Okay, anyway, continue.
Yeah, so the thing is, Gen Z has really embraced the dupe. Unlike back in the day where dupes were seen as cheap and tacky, you know, the attitude has shifted and now it's super trendy to buy dupes. So I think this conversation that we're about to hear provides some really great perspective on the economic times that we're living in and particularly how it's impacting young people. And I just love that Vibe Check took the time to analyze this trend because it's something that could have easily been dismissed as a silly TikTok trend.
Okay, this is Vibe Check.
My first question to both of you. So, you know, this writer notes that this trend is certainly being driven by Gen Z, by young people. Are you seeing dupes in real life, dupes on the street?
I mean, I see it, but I also want to be like, okay, girl, dupes have been here forever. I remember my mother back in the day buying knockoff Louis bags and knockoff Coach bags. And like, this is a thing that happens. Mm-hmm. And I read an article on dupes in The Atlantic by Amanda Mull, who I love.
She
covers
great.
Retail, commerce, business, consumption. And she said the difference between the knockoffs that us and our parents were doing and the dupes that Gen Z is doing, the Gen Zers take pride in the dupe.
Mm-hmm.
They go to TikTok to show off the dupe.
Yeah.
They're like, look what I did. I saved all this money.
Mm-hmm.
That's different than how it worked 20 years ago when you wanted no one to know
it was
that
like,
you
tell
had
tell no one. Yeah,
exactly.
My mom was a flight attendant for years and years. And I remember as a kid, particularly the international flight attendants that were going to places like Korea Brazil maybe would pride themselves on being able to take some of their time off and go get, we called them knockoffs, right?
Yeah.
And they would come back and bring, you know, the fake Louis Vuitton purses or whatever for their friends. So yeah, so is that the big shift? Are you noticing that, Zach? That it's like a point of pride?
Yes, 100%. So if you know me personally, like I've always been a girl that like I grew up reading Vogue. I wanted to be a fashion girly. I wanted luxury. I saved my coins and got a Prada wallet. Like I did the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember as a kid going to New York, going to Atlanta and seeing knockoffs for the first time and being like, should I? Shouldn't I? But if someone asked me, I'd have to lie. And I like suck at lying. And it was just this big like moral dilemma all the time. So I was a person that just believed in the hype of luxury. And as I've gotten older and TikTok has now blown up, I now get on every day and I'm filled with DHgate content. So if you're not familiar with DHgate, that is now the top girly in the world. So just to kind of differentiate a bunch of different
DHgate.
So this is a website.
So it's a website and app,
you know you're
really
talking to millennial twin.
I said, who is that?
Sam and I's eyes narrowed.
I thought it was a person. Well, think of that's a cute name. DHgate
is a China-based company that can get you the dupe of anything. So what I've seen, I guess the big overview is what I've seen is that there was a generation of millennials that were obsessed with, you know, getting the MacBook, getting the AirPods, whatever, getting the real one, saving up. And then lately, and through that process, we saw fast fashion emerge. So Zara, H&M, those places do knock off runway looks. They're the actual knockoff. So they're the version, but they're not going to have the label and then that says it's Prada, but it's going to look like Prada.
Okay.
But what has happened lately through the powers of DHgate, which is very, it's not the same as Shein. Shein is another like knockoff like Zara.
Now, I know Shein is the ghetto.
Shein is the
That's
ghetto.
The one thing I know about Shein.
That's the one thing I know.
But what we are seeing is you can get a dupe of anything. And DHgate, you should go on and try this out. You can do DHgate dupe of AirPod Maxes, which are $600 headphones. Uh-huh. They will send you for $50
really?
A dupe of it. You know, you can do Prada jackets, whatever. But now dupes have become blenders. They've become blow dryers. They've become technology.
Oh, so it's not even necessary luxury.
Not even
like blenders to me feels very different from designer purses.
This is what I find interesting though. So like when I hear these conversations about dupes, I'm like, oh, is it hurting these companies? Is it hurting Coach? Is it hurting Prada? From all we can tell, it helps these big brands because it increases buzz and awareness. And then in this piece from The Atlantic written by Amanda Mull, she points out that some brands even sell and market their own dupes. UGG, the boots, they have a dupe line.
Yeah.
They make a cheaper version of UGG with a different name and tell you all about it. This is wild. And this kind of gets me to like a thing that I've been thinking about a lot in dupe culture. Like Gen Z or dupe fans will say, look, I've beat the system. Mm-hmm. I've, you know, found this workaround to capitalism. I don't think so. It's still conspicuous consumption. Yeah. And it's still consumption, right? Yeah. And so my question with, you know, how we buy and what we buy, it's like, is the goal to find cheaper versions of all this stuff? Mm-hmm. Or should the goal just to be to buy and consume less stuff?
Yeah.
That's what I want.
And the consumption part is the kind of like, oh no part, because what I see on TikTok every day with the DHgate girls is a total dismissal of saving the environment. You know, due to fast fashion, we have seen, I think I saw a stat recently, we don't know where it comes from.
How young the folks making it are.
Exactly. Labor, like very illegal labor being used to produce them. But when you get past all these labor practices, climate practices, this is just about having more of enough of everything. Having it all constantly. Having it to your door within a day. And it just is kind of like, why are we spiraling towards this moment of like, I want to eat and consume everything when the planet is literally on fire? And I just like don't. It feels like for me, dupe culture is this interesting thing that has emerged out of Gen Z that was supposed to be the most socially conscious group of people in the world that care, that are supposed to save the world, which I think it's unfair to put that on them. But this has become an obsession with them online where it is actually kind of detrimental to the environment.
Yeah. And it's like dupe culture offers this way to like life hack consumption. Mm-hmm. But I want us to think about how to just curb our consumption.
Yeah.
Just to consume less. And what I think about a lot when I spend my money, it's like, all right, do I want to spend my money on things or on experiences? I want to spend my money on experiences.
That's a very millennial thing for
but
you to say.
But to go back to that BuzzFeed News article, like if it's noting factors like a new wave of cash poor teenagers, then I don't know. Things are more, like life is more expensive. These young people are paying more in rent than we ever did at their age. And yet, you know, I mean, think about Beyonce, you know, everything is more expensive than it used to be. So I don't know. To a certain extent, I guess I get certainly the allure of just paying less to maintain. It's kind of like keeping your head above water in the perception of where you think you should be.
Yes.
As opposed to, it feels, actually, dupe culture actually feels less, it feels less like aspirational culture and more like kind of maintaining.
Trying to keep
comfort.
Up.
I don't know.
Well, there's a pressure of performance as well. So like if you're someone who buys into the dupe lifestyle and you're on social media, there is a certain pressure to perform and look at a certain level of wealth in your TikToks, in your Instagram. If you rely on influencing to make money, you have to portray and assume a certain level of like performative wealth.
Yeah.
So there is a pressure. And I think like it's real. Like some people do make their money in this world and they have to look a certain way. I get that.
And I would argue, you know, obviously TikTok algorithms are very subjective to who you are and what you view and what you consume. But what I'm seeing emerge, and this dupe conversation, you know, here on Vibe Check is going to be ongoing because we're doing our own research and looking and keeping this going.
Research.
He said doing the research. So buying more dupes, Zach.
Listen, I will tell the girls, I have been buying dupes of things that I already own to see the differences in them. And they are like, you can't tell. Like it is really, really weird. It's a very weird thing. But what I want to get at with that is that idea of perception. Who do you think could and should have a real one? And who do you think does have a fake one? Which we've always seen steeped in anti-blackness, classism, all these things. Because when I was growing up, you would clock a girl, you see a girl at the mall with a Louis Vuitton, and you'd be like, that's fake. There's no way she could have it. When you would never say that about the white girl. So what is happening with these dupes, and what I think is exciting about dupe culture, when you take out all the environmental impact, which is awful, is a public critique of the obvious classism that is embodied in clothing and embodied in how we signal to each other. And that young people on TikTok are challenging that by saying, you know what? this is a fake.
That was Vibe Check. It's hosted by Sam Sanders, Zach Stafford, and Saeed Jones. It's produced by Chantel Holder. And that was associate producer Kelsey Cueva's pick for best podcast so far this year. Thanks, Kelsey.
Thank you.
I chatted with the Vibe Check host back in January. It was a really fun conversation. And if you want to hear it, you can find that in our show's feed on your favorite podcast app. This is Podcast Playlist, and I'm Leah Simone Bowen. Today, our team breaks down the best podcast so far in 2023.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Our next podcast was chosen by senior producer Kate Evans. Hey, Kate.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. And so what did you pick for us?
I picked The Turning Room of Mirrors. So this is the second season of The Turning, and it focuses on the legacy of ballet choreographer George Balanchine. And he's generally known as the father of American ballet. He co-founded the New York School of Ballet. And I heard about his style of dancing initially on a documentary called On Point. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't heard of it. And so what makes this show so special?
Well, something that I find really fascinating about ballet is that it's so graceful, it's so delicate, and yet we know from hearing from dancers how punishing it can be on your body. It's a very insular world, and dancers usually start when they're quite young. And I think all of this sort of lends itself to the story that is told in this podcast, which is that, you know, George Balanchine, though he was a genius, he was a bit of a problematic person and has a bit of a problematic legacy. Like, as we learn every day, all our faves are problematic, right? One story that really stuck with me from the podcast was about one of his former dancers who was kicked out of the school because she refused a marriage proposal from him. She was 23 and he was 60.
Oh, wow.
And so a lot of these dancers, they have such complicated feelings about their time with the school because there are all these great memories that are mixed in with some trauma and some confusion about how to feel. And I think the show, in terms of the way that it's produced, is incredibly fair. You know, it is reckoning with this problematic legacy, but it's also really respecting the stories of the dancers and giving them this space to talk about their experiences.
Okay, let's hear a bit from it now. In this clip, we're going to hear more about the impact George Balanchine had on the world of dance.
In the U.S., there is ballet before George Balanchine and ballet after George Balanchine. He's so in the water of American ballet that even now, it's hard to divorce him from what it is today. The beautiful parts and the hard parts. He grew up dancing for the Tsar in Russia and survived a revolution. But eventually, he landed in New York and created a ballet company, the New York City Ballet. He drew a blueprint for how to run a ballet school and a company under the rule of an artistic director. He emphasized devotion to the art form above all else. He choreographed pieces that were abstract, that colored outside the lines of traditional ballet. He integrated fast footwork and big movements into his technique, pushed dancers beyond their limits. These innovations vaulted him to a position of power few artists ever reach. Chances are, if you've danced ballet in America, Balanchine has affected you. I know he affected me. Last season, we talked about Mother Teresa, the most famous woman in the Catholic Church. She and Balanchine are very different. But if there's a Mother Teresa of American ballet, someone larger than life, I'd say it's George Balanchine. Like with Mother Teresa, there are myths and legends surrounding Balanchine. He was put on a pedestal, He created an insular world where dancers felt chosen, like they were part of something bigger, and it was intoxicating. Dancers described him as channeling his artistic vision from God, and dancers were the vessel for his art. And like with Mother Teresa, that can get very complicated. What was Balanchine's role in his dancers' lives or in your life?
He used to say, "I am your mother," in class. "I am a mother." He was everything.
Wilhelmina entered Balanchine's world for the first time in 1969. She was 13 years old. She had just left her family to move to New York on her own to attend Balanchine's school, the pipeline for his ballet company.
They had these old studios on the Upper West Side on 84th and Broadway.
There were stairs that led down into the studio where the class was held. And she remembers one day she looked up.
And what I thought was an old man who was standing at the top of the stairs, and he came down and he sat with the teacher, and suddenly he came over and he had his hands all over my body. I was doing arabesque.
She froze, suspended in arabesque, one leg lifted behind her, an arm outstretched in front of her face.
And he took my arabesque and he turned it so that it was a more open position and that my hand was lengthy and extended and looking over my eyes. And that was my introduction to George Balanchine. And I didn't really understand what he was doing, but I understand now that he was looking to see if I was capable of what his vision for technique for his ballets was.
It was her introduction to Balanchine's style of ballet, unlike anything she'd experienced before. Balanchine had this fantastical way of describing movement. He would tell dancers to present a foot as if it were a diamond placed on a red velvet pillow. Wilhelmina sensed that trusting him would lead to greatness.
You are blessed with having been in the presence of that kind of genius. And I was scared, I guess, that I might not measure up or I wasn't as good as the other kids. I was nervous about unlearning what I had been taught and relearning this new, complex, very demanding technique.
It was big, animated, acrobatic in ways that seemed physically impossible to pull off.
That technique, Balanchine used to describe it as more. He used to say, "More, more, more pork sausages, Mom, more." It was more, higher, faster, sleeker, extended. This technique was just take what you know and push it.
After that day in the classroom with Balanchine, Wilhelmina often noticed his eyes on her.
He was watching me.
How did it feel when Balanchine noticed you? When you could tell he was watching you?
You know, I loved it. You know, I loved it. I mean, how could you not love it? But at one point, he kept pulling me front. And it became kind of embarrassing because I had friends that it wasn't happening to. People would assume that you were flirting or doing, you know, and there was jealousy around it, and that you were getting close to him because you wanted to dance better parts.
Balanchine had a track record of blurring the professional and the personal, falling in love with his favorite dancers, and marrying some of them. At 16, Wilhelmina became an apprentice with New York City Ballet, the transition from student to potential professional dancer in Balanchine's company.
We got dressed up for class because you wanted him to pay attention to you. Everybody wore flowers in their hair, and he spoke like that. He spoke so quietly, like in a rehearsal. Only dancers could hear him.
You had to be totally tuned into him.
Totally tuned in. Well, he completely wanted all of our attention. and all of our devotion, not unlike the convent. We were not supposed to be interested in men. Balanchine felt like if we were distracted by a man, it would pull us away from what he wanted us to do. He really wanted us to be completely and totally just deeply involved in our dancing. He didn't really want you to have children. He didn't really want you to get married. So nobody got married, or if they did, it was in secret. And you hid your boyfriend.
Wilhelmina learned this the hard way.
I was at a cafe across from Lincoln Center called Fiorello's, and I was with a date.
And who should walk by but Balanchine? He stopped in front of them.
And he looked at the guy and he said, Wilhelmina has the ability to make a man relax. I think it was sort of an insult to the guy.
And then he turned to Wilhelmina and he said,
dear, you think you're in Paris, but you're not. And I went, okay, got it, you know.
What was he saying? Because I feel like often I hear quotes from Balanchine and they're indirect and I don't know exactly what they mean.
They're indirect and he was sarcastic, very sarcastic. I think what he meant by that is, you know, New York, you're sitting outdoors, the buses go by and it's, you know, loud and dirty, but you're not here in the romance of Paris with this gentleman. I just took that as, I'm not that happy about this. You know, especially because it's kind of like I was on his turf in a way, right across the street. I laughed. You know, I just laughed at it. He was just out to like just destroy my time with the guy, I think, you know, whatever. I think he was just throwing his weight around, Mr. B. Letting the guy know she's mine. I had her first, right? I had her first.
You know, at the same time, he's having relationships with some of his dancers.
He did. Yeah, he did. You know, I don't know that I thought about it that much at the time. It was just the way it was.
Balanchine asked his dancers to keep their mind in the studio. In the studio, he asked for their complete trust.
He used to say, what are you looking at? In terms of, as a dancer, we look in the mirror, right? So he'd say, what are you looking at, dear? You can't see you, only I can see you.
To Wilhelmina, it meant the mirror could lie.
You're just seeing an image of yourself fleeting as you're going by. The audience is seeing something different. Don't listen to the mirror, listen to my voice. You can't see you, only I can see you.
From Rococo Punch and iHeart Podcast, that was The Turning, Room of Mirrors. It's hosted, written, and produced by Erica Lance. Their team includes Eileen Lance Lesser and Emily Foreman. And that clip was brought to us by senior producer Kate Evans. Thanks, Kate.
Thanks so much.
You're listening to Podcast Playlist. I'm Leah Simone Bowen. Today on the show, it's the best podcast of the year so far as chosen by our team. Last but not least is producer Julian Uzielli. Hey, Julian.
Hey, Leah.
So what have you got for us today?
My choice is the CBC podcast Let's Not Be Kidding, hosted by Gavin Crawford. I'm sure you remember we just had him on the show a couple weeks ago.
Yes.
So this is sort of an autobiographical podcast that he's made. It's about him and his mom, Donna, their relationship and her journey with dementia. See, she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's 5 years ago. And as anybody who has a family member with Alzheimer's knows, that's a very difficult and long and bumpy road to go down. And Gavin is a comedian, of course, and he makes this show. It's obviously there are sad parts because dementia is sad and Alzheimer's is a sad, awful disease. But there's a lot of funny moments that can happen that maybe don't seem funny at the time, but they're funny later, or they're hilarious at the time, but it's really difficult to get someone else to understand how funny it is when they're too busy feeling bad for you about the Alzheimer's. So it's sad, but it's also surprisingly funny. He has, you know, interviews with other comedians who've got family members with Alzheimer's, like Scott Thompson from Kids in the Hall and Aurora Brown from Baroness von Sketch Show. And not just comedians, but other entertainers too, like Jane Arden, for example, makes a repeat appearance on the show.
Right. And so why did you pick this for the best podcast of the year so far?
This is a topic that people generally don't really like to talk about. It makes them uncomfortable. They don't like to talk about it when it's affecting them, and they don't like it to hear about it when it's affecting other people. So it's very much under discussed, but it's something that affects a lot of us. And anyway, so he takes this topic that is kind of a social taboo, and he not only makes it interesting, but he makes it funny. He admits that, yeah, this is sad, but you have to laugh to cope, because what else are you going to do? You can't cry all the time. And so this is him doing that. And it's this really, really beautiful, beautifully done. And I just think listening to the show, you feel like you get to know his mom and him. And you can tell that he really has a lot of love for her.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a really beautiful podcast. So let's listen to some of it now. This is Let's Not Be Kidding.
The funny thing is, I think the way that I learned how to deal with my mother looping or having memory lapses and not be too frustrated about it, I actually learned from my mother before this happened. Because her mother, my grandma Jean, also had Alzheimer's. When I was about 18 to 25. And my mom would go and visit her every day and try and make us go and visit as often as we could. But she would always say, just roll with her. Whatever she says, whatever she thinks, just roll with it. And I thought I was prepared for that until I got there and I walked into the room and my grandmother was just sitting in a chair in the middle of the room. And then she was like, oh, thank God, you're finally here. And then she said, like, just take a little. I don't want you to take too much off, just a little bit. And I realized that she had decided I was a hairdresser and that she was at the hairdresser. She was a little mad at me for being late. At first, I was a little bit offended because I thought it was kind of homophobic. That I was like, of course. Oh, I'm the gay hairdresser? And I didn't know what to do, so I gave her a trim. I remember getting home and telling my mother, and my mother being like, what? You did what? And I was like, well, you said roll with it. And then my mom just kind of rolled her eyes and muttered good grief and gave me that little wry smile.
She'd always just say, what direction is this? Like north, south, which is, it's completely irrelevant question wherever we are. It doesn't matter. It was just a way she would say she doesn't know where she is.
This is my husband, Kyle.
She'd just say, are we going north right now? And then as it progressed, the are we going north right now is like, where, like what city is this? Like it just kind of changed from, what area of Toronto is this when we're not in Toronto at all or whatever? So
I think honestly, one of my favorite things of during that time was watching you try to head my mom off from cleaning up the kitchen.
I tried everything. It just was, you could not.
Like you did try things though. Like what would you try? I can't even remember.
I would just be like, look, you're on vacation. You don't need to worry about this. Just go and sit down, go watch TV or I would just give her options of anything else to do besides help. Like, I just didn't need. She's like, oh, I'll just get this done. I'm like, I just gave up at some point. Like, you just can't. You would have to physically restrain her to keep her from putting where it wasn't supposed to go.
Alexis told me when my mom was up there staying with her, my mom, for some reason, took all of Alexis's forks and put them in a box in the basement to donate to the Salvation Army.
Well, she was probably right.
Alexis is a sister just younger than me, and to be fair, she has always had lovely forks. It was a long month, that December. It was cold, and it was harrowing, and it was hilarious. But probably my favorite thing that happened that Christmas, I guess it happened sort of because of Kyle. It's weird how my mom developed a real affinity for Kyle as the years went on. It took about 24 years for her to move from, like, who is this gay guy that's pulling Gavin too far down the rainbow road to, like, the man who could do no wrong, who had such an impeccable design sense. And he really did. I mean, when Kyle does a Christmas tree, it looks like the Christmas tree at the Hudson Bay. And I think my mom really appreciated that, because all of our whole lives, my mom was very specific about our Christmas tree. It had to be a certain height, and it had to be flocked. I don't know if you know what flocking is, but it was very big in the 70s. Everybody loved to flock a tree. It was fake snow that you would use the vacuum cleaner on blow to mix up this kind of wet, white powder. Dad would take the tree out to the garage and flock it. It's always very funny when we were kids. We'd be like, where's Dad? He's out flocking the tree, my mom would say. And then it would harden into a beautiful kind of snowy powder on all the needles. So he had a flocked tree with yellow lights, very specific ornaments that were braided wheat from IKEA. Any ornaments from our childhood went on a separate tree that was put in my bedroom, where I was allowed to have colored lights and all the crafty ornaments that we wanted. But my mother did not want our kid ornaments anywhere near the beautiful living room Christmas tree. Anyway, somehow that December, my mom suddenly decided that Kyle must have invented the Christmas tree. We would be sitting there in the evening. She'd be sipping a Coke, which you like to do. I'd have a record on, trying to avoid being asked a question. And she'd kind of glance over at the tree. And then she'd think for a bit, and then she'd say, whose idea was that? And I was like, what? She'd be like, who thought of that, to bring a tree inside and put lights on it? Was that Kyle? I bet it was Kyle. And for a minute, I didn't know what she was talking about. I'd be like, yeah, well, Kyle decorates it, you know. I mean, you always had nice trees. And she would be like, yeah. I mean, imagine bringing a tree inside. Only Kyle would think of that. He has really got an eye. And I realized that it was like she was seeing a Christmas tree for the very first time and thought, what a goldmine of an idea Kyle had hit upon. She said one time, we should call your sisters and tell them to do this, because this looks really good. Like, you know, I bet everyone would do this if they saw it. Leave it to Kyle.
Now, how do I take that? Would it be flattering that she thinks I designed a centuries-old tradition dating before Christianity? I don't know. Like, it's just one of those things that happens with that disease.
And I mean, at a certain point, what are you going to do? You just roll with it. So I guess next Christmas, if you're going to put a tree in your house and decorate it all up to celebrate the season, thank my husband, Kyle. It was his idea. Bum, bum. Ba-ba-da-ba-da-ba.
From CBC Podcasts, that was Let's Not Be Kidding. It's hosted by Gavin Crawford. Their team includes David Carroll, Emily Quinnell, Pete Morey, and Damon Fairless. Thanks, Julian.
Thanks, Leah.
I had a really great chat with Gavin Crawford a few weeks ago about this podcast. You can find that in our show's feed wherever you listen to podcasts. So those are our picks for the best podcasts of the year so far. What do you think? Are we right? Any glaring omissions? You can send us an email to let us know at podcastplaylist@cbc.ca or find us on social media. And that's the show. And the Podcast Playlist team is...
Julian Uzielli, producer.
Kelsey Cueva, associate producer.
Kate Evans, senior producer.
Cecil Fernandez, executive producer.
And I'm Leah Simone Bowen. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.